Okay, I'm back. This time I've got two pages. So. So today we're going to be looking at a couple stories in Samuel again. I'm not going to do like I did last time where we, looked at it and asked the question, where is Jesus in the story? You can keep that in the back of your head if you want, but... So I'm just going to read a couple stories. They're pretty similar stories. It's kind of the same thing happening in both of them, just slightly different circumstances. So I'm going to be in 1 Samuel 24, and then I'll read a bit from 1 Samuel 26 as well. So here we go. Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, "Take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. So he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave. And Saul went in to attend to his needs. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. Then the men of David said to him, "This is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.'" And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And he said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord." So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. David also arose afterward, went out of the cave, and called out to Saul, saying, "My lord the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed down. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Indeed, David seeks your harm. Look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave. And someone urged me to kill you, but my eyes spared you. And I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Moreover, my father, see... Yes, see the corner of your robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you. Know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand, and I have not sinned against you, yet you hunt my life to take it. Let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me on you. But my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog, a flea? Therefore, I let the Lord be judge, and judge between you and me, and see and plead my case, and deliver me out of your hand." So it was, when David had finished speaking these words to Saul, that Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. Then he said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you with evil. And you have shown this day how you have dealt well with me, for when the Lord delivered me into your hand, you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely? Therefore, may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now I know indeed that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Therefore, swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house." So David swore to Saul, and Saul went home. But David and his men went up to the stronghold. And chapter 26 is a very similar story, still Saul chasing David. So I'll read a little bit of it, but not the whole thing. "Now the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, 'Is David not hiding in the hill of Hakilah opposite Jeshimon?' Then Saul rose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped in the hill of Hakilah, which is opposite Jeshimon by the road. But David stayed in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. David therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul had indeed come. So David arose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. And David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Now Saul lay within the camp with the people encamped all around him. Then David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother of Joab, saying, 'Who will go down with me to Saul in the camp?' And Abishai said, 'I will go down with you.' So David and Abishai came to the people by night, And there Saul lay sleeping within the camp, with a spear stuck in the ground by his head. And Abner and the people lay all around him. Then Abishai said to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please let me strike him at once with the spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time. But David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? David said furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But please take now the spear and the jug of water that are by his head and let us go. So David took the spear and the jug of water by Saul's head and they got away. And no man saw or knew it or awoke, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. And I'll just stop there. So, and we've got two stories, very similar, of Saul going after David and David having an opportunity to take him out and refusing. Of course, it's a strange situation because, as we know, Saul and David had been quite close for a long time. David was Saul's son-in-law. He was married to his daughter after he had defeated Goliath. He was best friends with Saul's son, Jonathan. They loved each other. They were closer than brothers, Scripture says. David was also the one who played the harp for Saul whenever he was not in his right mind. He was one of Saul's mightiest military leaders. And so they had a lot of years of being close to each other. David even ate at Saul's table in the kingdom. But by this point, we'd seen that Saul had fallen, right? He had been rejected by God in chapter 15 after God commanded him to kill all the Amalekites and destroy everything there. He wasn't completely obedient in that. He was jealous of David because he knew that David was going to be the next king. And because David had many great military achievements and the people were constantly singing his praises over Saul's. And of course, he wants Jonathan to become king after him, right? So we've got all these different things, and we see that the relationship between the two of them, David and Saul, has changed dramatically over the years. But the thing I want to kind of focus on most in these two stories, it's something that's always really stood out to me in this, and that in both stories, David is presented with Saul, and in both stories, one of David's men tells him. So in verse 4 of chapter 24, it says, the men of David said to him, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you. And then in verse 8 of chapter 26, then Abishai said to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please let me strike him at once with the spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time. And then back in verse 10 of 24, we see that David acknowledges this. He says, look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave. And someone urged me to kill you. And even Saul acknowledges this later on when he's responding in verse 18. It says, and you have shown this day how you have dealt well with me, for when the Lord delivered me into your hand, you did not kill me. And again, David mentions it again in the second story in verse 23. May the Lord repay every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I would not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. So we see that there's several acknowledgments in both of these stories that this wasn't just a chance happening that they ended up in the same place, but that it was actually the Lord bringing Saul to David and giving him the opportunity to kill Saul. Right? He didn't just show up and all that. It was a very deliberate act there. And even in the second story, it says God had put a heavy sleep and all the people around Saul, and that's how they were able to get in there. So I've always found that very interesting that God actually presented David with these opportunities, and he's obviously giving David a choice, right? A test from God. He says, David, I believe, has every right to kill Saul in both those situations, right? Saul has been chasing him for years without really any cause. David has already been anointed the next king, so really he's just taking what's already his, right? He knows that Saul is a lot of the time not in his right mind. In both these stories, you see Saul is so obsessed with this that he's taken 3,000 of Israel's choicest men to come after one man. You know, he could have just sent some assassins out or something, you know, but he goes out there himself, leaves Israel to go and chase after this one man. Of course, David knows that he's had troubles with spirits. He's there obviously playing the harp for him regularly. And so, you know, he's got the right of being anointed the next king. He's got self-defense. You know, he's just trying to preserve himself. And I don't think any of us, I certainly wouldn't have ever faulted David if he took those opportunities and killed Saul, right? But even with that, we know that David chooses not to do this. And so we ask, why would David make this choice? And the reason he gives several times is Saul was God's anointed. And David says several times, I will not stretch out my hand against God's anointed. And we see how committed he is to this idea of Saul being the anointed and not doing it in 2 Samuel 1, after Saul has died in battle. He was fighting the Philistines, and they were chasing him, and he knew he was going to end, and Saul had asked his armor-bearer to kill him, essentially. The armor-bearer refused, of course, and so Saul fell on his sword. Armor-bearer does the same thing, and then we find that the Philistines find Saul, take his head, put him on display in one of their buildings. And then in the first chapter of 2 Samuel, an Amalekite comes to David to tell him this story. He says that, and I assume he was quite happy to bring this news to David, that Saul is now dead. And David asks him, how do you know this? And the Amalekite tells him that, well, I found him on his sword, and he was still alive, and asked me to end his life because he knew things were going to go bad, so I killed him. And he took his crown, and I think it was the bracelet on his arm, as proof. And of course, David's response is probably quite different from what the Amalekite thought it would be. He cries in anguish over the loss of Saul. But once he finishes that, he actually asks the man, he says in verse 14 of chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, he says, how is it you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Right? So you can see that David has mentioned several times before, I will not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And then he asks this man the same question, and then right after that, he commands one of his men to execute this man for killing God's anointed. And I'm sure the guy was real surprised that he thought he was coming there with some good news that David would enjoy, but ends up dead instead. And so we can see that the reason for all of this that David does is his fear of the Lord. Right? He's more afraid of going against God's anointed than he is of being killed by Saul. He'll run out and hide in the wilderness for days and years if it prevented him from having to kill Saul. And he even says, you know, one day, I think it's in chapter 26 here, verse 10, David said, furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or shall go out to battle and perish. So, we can never really know how David's kingship would have been if he had chosen to kill Saul. Chances are guilt would have been with him his whole kingship, over not just killing the Lord's anointed, but killing someone close to him, his own father-in-law. But certainly the guilt of killing God's anointed, it probably would have set the tone for his entire kingship. You know, that would have followed him through all those years, that thought of, you know, I killed God's anointed. And even though he knew he was promised to be king, he was anointed to be there, and he still would not go out of his way to do that. He wasn't even going out of his way. The Lord brought Saul to him. So then we can contrast David's actions with some of Saul's. Saul had several major failings in his time as king. Probably the first big one was when Saul chose to perform a sacrifice before battle. They had a battle, and it was all set up for Samuel to come and perform a sacrifice before the battle. That was something that they did, and, you know, grant God's favor as they go out and fight. And it says the appointed days for Samuel to arrive had already passed, and people were leaving Saul and dispersing. Things were getting pretty bad, so Saul decides to take it upon himself to perform the sacrifice. That's in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel. And when Samuel does arrive, he tells, you know, he's quite upset and says, "What have you done?" Saul says very innocently in his own mind, "That's, oh, well, you weren't here, so we got to do a sacrifice, so I did the sacrifice." And Samuel tells him that, you know, if you had waited, your kingdom would have been established forever. And now because of this, it's going to end with you, right? No descendants are going to come after you and continue being king. And then the next thing, as I had already mentioned, was when God commanded him to kill all the Amalekites, destroy all their animals, the sheep, goats, and everything. And again, Saul decides to spare King Agag and keeps a whole bunch of the best sheep, the best oxen, and again claims, well, this is for the Lord. You know, we're sacrifice all these things, we'll enjoy them. And a line that my mom always liked to use when we were kids comes from one of these stories, show us is obedience is better than sacrifice. And I think her context for it was a little bit different. It was usually after we had already done something that we weren't supposed to do. And she says, well, you should have obeyed because now you're going to have to sacrifice. Or in this context, is, you know, you obey instead of doing the sacrifice and you would have been okay. So those are the two big contrasts. You got two major situations where Saul, you know, was presented with a choice, and he was given direct commandments on what was supposed to happen and decides to go in a different direction with it. And those two things completely derailed his whole life, his whole everything that he was expecting to come as being the first king of Israel. And David chooses to not take that path, right? So David's choice gives an example of a few things. The first one, something that I'm sure we've all heard about many times in our lives, is waiting on the Lord to fulfill the promises and plans that he has for us, right? We, of course, have all the promises in the Bible that God gives us. I assume several people here at least have probably been given prophecies in their lives for things that they might do or become. And when those come, we get very excited, for some of them anyway. Some of them are quite daunting. But, you know, you get in this thing in your head that, okay, I know this is coming, and you want to get it to come as quickly as possible, right? So you're doing everything you can to accelerate that. And that's what David would have been doing. He knew that he was destined to be king. He was anointed. And had he taken Saul's life, he would have been king the next day probably, right? But instead, he sits and waits and lets it come in God's time. And there's a big difference between, you know, because when we do have those promises, when God tells us, you know, you're going to be this or do this, there is Waiting isn't just sitting down and doing nothing until this thing comes to you, right? There is preparation involved in all that. And there's a big difference between preparing ourselves for God's promises or plans and trying to fulfill them ourselves, right? I remember years ago, it must have been Leroy talking about his son Eddie and how he had been prophesied that football was going to be a big, you know, part of his future. And of course, I think most of us know it was a big part of his future. But, you know, Eddie didn't sit down for 15 years and never play football and then was just presented with an opportunity to play professional football, right? He spent years and years playing and practicing and training. And then he got to the point where, you know, he got into professional football. He spent all those years preparing for what had been promised to him. And you see David doing the same thing. He spends all these years, you know, he's in the presence of Saul, learning from a king. He's around military leaders. He's learning from them. And of course, he was very, very close to God himself, right? He, being the shepherd, God was there with him to help him defend the sheep. And so we know that David was preparing for this day. And then the second thing that we get from this is something that we might not be as familiar with, and that is being willing to set aside our right to make choices for ourselves and letting God make the choice for you. And this is something that I'm glad I've got. This just happened to be here. I have one of these, My Utmost for His Highest. I'm sure most of the people here have read through this. I've read through it a couple times, but I don't know where mine is now. With all the moving around and stuff, it's probably in a box. But well, I'm glad it's here, because I did have it on my phone, but this will be easier to get, maybe. But there's one. I've read through this, I think, twice completely, My Utmost for His Highest, and there's one particular day that has always stuck with me. I'll read that in a second. But yeah, the idea of setting aside our own right to make choices for ourselves and leaving it up to God. Because often when we're presented with choices, we tend to think of it as there's a good choice and there's a bad choice, there's a right and a wrong. But lots of times, there's actually two good choices, right? There isn't, you know, it's not you go this way, you get, and they both seem good. And I think in this situation with David, he's there. God has brought Saul to him. He's presented with this choice. Either one of them is going to end with him being king, right? And like I said earlier, I don't think any of us would have faulted him for taking that opportunity for, you know, to defend himself, to rid Israel of a, you know, seemingly poor king and moving into his promised place as king of Israel. But even in that situation, when there's two good choices, I believe that there is still one choice that is God's preference. Right? And yes. And so so on May 25th of My Utmost for His Highest, it's in reference to the story of Abraham and Lot from Genesis 13, where I guess they've been living together for a little while, and their properties, their herds are getting a little bit bigger, they're getting a little bit crowded, and so Abraham decides that instead of, you know, our herdsmen fighting amongst each other over where they're going to eat, let's just split up. And he tells Lot, you know, you choose. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right, and then we'll be separated and everybody will be happy. So that's the story behind this. So I'll read a bit of this, and it's called The Test of Self-Interest. And then, of course, if thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. And Oswald Chambers says, as soon as you begin to live the life of faith in God, fascinating and luxurious prospects will open up before you. And these things are yours by right. But if you are living the life of faith, you will exercise your right to waive your rights and let God choose for you. God sometimes allows you to get into a place of testing where your own welfare would be the right and proper thing to consider if you were not living a life of faith. But if you are, you will joyfully waive your right and leave God to choose for you. This is the discipline by means of which the natural is transformed into the spiritual by obedience to the voice of God. Whenever right is made the guidance in the life, it will blunt the spiritual insight. The great enemy of the life of faith in God is not sin, and this is the part of this that sticks with me the most. The great enemy of the life of faith in God is not sin, but the good which is not good enough. The good is always the enemy of the best. It would seem the wisest thing in the world for Abraham to choose. It was his right, and the people around him would consider him a fool for not choosing. Many of us do not go on spiritually because we prefer to choose what is right instead of relying on God to choose for us. We have to learn to walk according to the standard which has its eye on God. Walk before me. So, of course, these are, you know, slightly different stories. In Abraham's case, he has the right to choose, of course, right? He could have come out and told Lot, all right, we're splitting up. I'm going to go over there because it's real nice, real pretty. You can go over there. And Lot would have just had to go along with it, right? But instead, he comes out and says, we're going to split up. You pick where you want to go, and I'll just go the rest of the way. And immediately after that, God speaks to Abraham, and he's rewarded for this, right? He's rewarded for this, but God tells him, look at all the land, north, south, east, west. All of this is going to be for you and your descendants. And of course, Abraham is not expecting this when he goes to Lot. He's not, you know, putting anything in the bank. He just says, you know, it doesn't matter to me. You choose. I trust in the Lord. And God rewards him with a promised land for his descendants that he says will number more than the sand on the beach and the stars in the sky. And just as it would seem the wisest thing in the world for Abraham to choose and not just leave it up to Lot where he ends up going, it would seem the wisest thing in our eyes for David to dispatch of King Saul. Right? He's out there with all these men hiding in the wilderness, hiding amongst Philistines, going all these places. He's not just doing it for his own sake, but he's also dispatching of a king, like I said, who's kind of leaving Israel on its own to go out and hunt this man. You know, he's obviously lost favor with God. He's not following the will of God anymore. And so, you know, you got that other angle of David removing this man from Israel. And again, surely none of us would have faulted him for it. But in both of these situations, these men are rewarded by God for their faith. Right? So like I said, Abraham was rewarded with the land for his descendants, and David is rewarded by becoming a successful king and having sons that go on to do great, great things in Israel. And even with their faults, their sins, we know Abraham and David were not perfect men, and their failings, we still remember them for their faith and for the moments that they chose to let God lead them, and they chose to follow the Lord instead of taking things for themselves when they felt like it. And we remember their commitment to God and for the righteous choices they make. So this idea of setting aside our own right to make choices and letting God do it, it's quite a foreign kind of concept to us, right? We like to be in control of our daily lives, of our destinies, of our future. And even when we know that there are things promised to us, we still try to force them to come a little bit faster. And like I said, with the waiting, it's not just sitting there and doing nothing. Sometimes it feels like that. My wife would probably tell me I'm procrastinating. I'm just waiting on the Lord. Give him a minute. But you know, waiting is, yeah, I think the waiting on the Lord is an active waiting, right? You're preparing, you're communicating with the Lord about where you go, and taking the opportunities to not make choices can also just seem like, you know, you're too afraid to make a choice one way or another. You know, you're not confident in yourself. But it's, I think it's something that we need to become more comfortable with not pushing in the directions we feel like we need to go, and letting God move with us. And it's, I think these examples of David are just, they're spectacular. And again, especially because we hear from David's men, from David himself, and even Saul, that they've all acknowledged that it's the Lord who brings this opportunity to David and lets him make the choice about what he's going to do with it. He says, are you going to take it now, or are you going to wait for my timing? Are you going to let me bring you into this thing that I've promised you? So I'm just going to end again with my utmost for his highest. Because of all the things, like I said, I've read through this a few times. That's the one thing that's been in my head for years, the one that I've held on to. And this is the greatest enemy of the life of faith in God is not sin, but good choices which are not quite good enough. The good is always the enemy of the best. So I'll just pray for you guys, pray for everybody. All right. So Lord, we thank you. We thank you for these excellent examples that you've given us in your word of men who have chosen to follow you, to fear you, to have faith in you and your plans and your promises. We thank you, Lord, that these men don't only exist in the Bible, but we have them around us today. And we ask you, Lord, that you help us to become these kinds of people, that we don't feel the need to control every aspect of our lives, or even just control the larger part of our lives, Lord, but that we trust in you, we believe in your faithfulness, and your promises from the Bible, and the promises that you've given us individually in our lives about where we're going, about what we're going to do, and just about how much you care for us, Lord. I pray you give us all the revelation of that so we can learn to fear you in a way that is respectful to you, Lord, and loving of you, and move forward fully in with your will, Lord, in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.